Good Journalism Once Upon a Time. That was your aggressive reporter with a pen and pad that would tell the truth in an unbiased way. Now, they are so agenda-driven, and the point of journalism should be to shine light on the truth.
Welcome to the Edify Podcast, where our guests share practical wisdom on living our faith in public. I'm Mary Fiorito. Thank you for joining us today. Mary Margaret Olihan is a senior reporter at the Daily Signal and a powerhouse in conservative journalism. Mary Margaret, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, such a pleasure to be able to sit down with you. I have long been a fan of your work. So a lot of what you talk about in your Edify video is about how to spot kind of fraudulent or, you know, stories that are written in a certain way that really betray kind of an underlying ideology. Mm-hmm. So many people, you know, I know, and I know I don't speak, you know, I'm not a rare person in this, but they've stopped watching or reading the news altogether because it can be so depressing and they feel like it's so biased. Mm-hmm. What's your response to that? And how do you deal with it as somebody who's actually working in this field as a reporter?
Well, that's a great question. And it's something that I think about often at church, actually, because you'll go to mass and priests will say, you know, the news is so negative. If you have to, turn it off. Don't watch the news. Don't read the news. And I kind of laugh because I have to. So I'm like, oh, Father, that's good advice, but I can't do it. And I think that there is definitely something to be said for turning off, spending time in prayer, spending time getting your work done, spending time with your family, all those things that are so important. But I also think we have an obligation to be tuned into the news. I think that we need to know what's going on. I bumped into a man on the train the other day who told me that he hadn't been tuned into the news for the past several years, and he wanted to know what the most important thing going on was. Mm-hmm. And this is a man I had never met before. I wasn't about to, you know, tell him everything that's going on in the news, but I stopped for a second and thought, oh my gosh, mm-hmm. so many things have happened in the past several years that will impact our nation forever. It will impact our culture forever. And if you don't know, how do you even start to tell someone?
Right.
All these things build on each other. You know, people have been predicting forever that really explicit sex education in schools would lead to one thing after another. And now we have in California lawmakers saying that if a kid in school decides that they are another gender and their parents don't affirm that, those kids can be taken away from their families.
Right.
And that's just one example of this snowball effect of how these things go. So I think that a really good way for us to stay tuned into the news is to find people that we respect and see what kind of news they share.
Mm-hmm.
I think a good example of this is Matt Walsh. There's a lot of Catholics that like him. He'll talk about really important topical things. People like him, you can tune in, listen, and then tune out. And if that's how you want to do it. But if you want to be looking for really good, fair, and accurate reporting, I really like reading, of course, the Daily Signal, where I work. I think the Daily Wire does a great job. I think the Daily Caller does an excellent job. Wall Street Journal is probably the most middle of the road you
right.
can find. They definitely lean slightly left, but they're still a great source of news.
Well, their feature stories lean slightly left, but their editorial pages kind of, I think,
are
slightly to the right or kind of centrist and, you know, right-leaning slightly. So it's an interesting, I think, healthy tension there.
Yes, definitely. And when I was saying these outlets, I guess I'm thinking like the news side of things.
Right.
But that's a great point. I really love their editorial page.
Right.
And, of course, Fox News has some really good reporting, even though they have some issues with their corporate side of things.
You know who I follow now is Barry Weiss at the Free Press.
She has an awesome website.
She is so interesting. And so she was a New York Times reporter, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And was very much dismayed by the way in which she was being pressured to kind of make stories a little more
mm-hmm.
leaning in a certain way, or, you
right.
know, she felt that there was real bias. And so she just sort of left on her own.
Yeah.
And she isn't somebody, I think, personally, who would be, you know, seen as a conservative. So
no.
that made her story all the more interesting.
Yeah, I've loved her reporting recently. And you're right that because she wasn't seen as right-leaning or she wasn't right-leaning.
Right.
She was just someone that cared about the truth. I think a lot of people pay attention to her reporting now that wouldn't have otherwise.
Right.
For example, the Free Press, I believe, is her
yes,
publication.
The Free Press.
They broke this amazing story about a whistleblower in Missouri who blew the whistle on these gender clinics and has potentially done more good to expose that whole situation than so many other people could ever have dreamed.
She said she was a Bernie Sanders voter.
Yeah.
She describes herself as a queer woman mm-hmm. who was working in this transitioning clinic, thinking she was being helpful to transgender youth mm-hmm. and gender dysphoric people. And what she saw horrified her, and she walked away from it. Very powerful testimony.
So powerful. And the fact that she felt, I guess, I don't like saying this word, but she felt safe enough to go to an outlet like the Free Press and say, I want to share my story with you. And I know that it won't be politicized mm-hmm. by either side of the aisle. That kind of story and those kinds of reporting, I think, are making a huge difference right now.
Yep.
Another sort of middle of the road news source that I like is Sagar and Jetty's podcast that he has with Crystal Ball. I think it used to be called Breaking Points. I don't know if that's still what it's called. Mm-hmm. But Sagar used to work at the Daily Caller, and he was a really fierce reporter there. And then he went and had this show at the Hill with Crystal, who's very left-leaning, and they both talk about issues from both sides of the aisle. And it's a really cool way to listen to the news.
Oh, my goodness. They disagree, but they can actually speak to each other. Like, this is, you know, how sad that we have to, like, point this out as being something, like, you know, groundbreaking in some way.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I think, too, Ed Morrissey over at Hot Air is...
Oh, yeah, he does a great job.
He does a great job. Uh-huh. I think he's very fair. And The Hayride also, I think, is very fair. Uh-huh. And they really, they back up everything that they say with facts, which is what I like about them. I mean, they have a reference point or a, you know, substantiation of everything they claim. But I think really where all of this, don't watch the news, just turn it off for a while. Mm-hmm. I think it started... Because I remember it very, very clear after 9/11 happened, because people, you know, there really wasn't much of an internet, you know, and so people were just watching, had something on 24/7. People had their TVs on, just watching the updates. And then finally, mental health professionals started to put out warning saying, you know, you can't, this is carrying trauma into your life day after day.
Right.
You are not helping. People actually thought they were being unpatriotic by turning their TVs off.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, but at the time, it felt like you were doing something to contribute if you were sitting in front of that television all day long. And, you know, the mental health professionals started to say, it is okay for you to turn off your TV and take a break from this. You know, you are not a first responder via the television. And so you can just...
Interesting.
I remember that very distinctly, because I was at a certain age and I just felt like how could you turn off the TV? You have to know what's going on at every moment, even though it was just kind of basically replaying the same news because, you know, there wasn't a whole lot to report. So I think... For a lot of people, they realized how much those visuals, seeing them over and over again, were affecting them and impacting them psychologically. So,
and now with the internet, things are—it's different, but it's so much worse in that respect, because you're constantly inundated with all this very quick-moving, fast-paced, awful, negative content any time of the day, especially on social media platforms where a lot of youth are.
Right. Right, exactly. And well, tell me, what do you think, what does good journalism look like?
Good journalism, I think, has, you know, when we talk about this, we should differentiate between what it used to be and what it is now. Because I think, in theory, good journalism once upon a time, that was your aggressive reporter with a pen and pad that would tell the truth in an unbiased way. And we've gotten to the point now where those mainstream, I hate saying mainstream media, but there's not really very many good words for this, mainstream corporate, what do you call it, fake news media, they are so agenda-driven that there has to be other outlets that are on the conservative or right-leaning side of things that are filling in the gaps that these agenda-driven outlets leave.
Right.
And at the end of the day, the point of journalism should be to shine light on the truth. But what conservative media finds ourselves doing a lot of the time is filling the gaps that the mainstream media leaves open.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say that, I mean the mainstream media make no bones about the fact that they think abortion is a right. They say abortion rights in their stories.
100%.
They call irreversible sex change surgeries for kids care.
Mm-hmm.
They also call abortion care.
Yeah, right.
Gender-affirming care.
Right.
All of this, they use the activist terms of progressive organizations like the ACLU and GLAAD and the Human Rights Campaign. A lot of these news outlets are owned by corporations that follow the very specific lefty standards of the Human Rights Campaign.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they're all being controlled and fed the glossaries and vocabulary of these leftist organizations, they are not unbiased. And then on the other side of the aisle, you have places like the Daily Caller, where I got my start, where we felt that we existed to fill the void that the mainstream media left. Mm. And so Daily Caller is really good at hypocrisy stories, showing this person said this, but they did this. They did a lot of reporting like that. And I think conservative media, unfortunately, has to carry the burden of showing people the truth in areas that maybe they wouldn't have if the mainstream media was doing their job.
Right.
And so while I think that once upon a time, the goal of journalism was to shine light on the truth, now you have people who care about a lot of different alleged truths, and we're all trying to show it at the same time.
Right. Well, one thing that, if you speak to anybody, for example, who works in the pro-life movement or who worked in the pro-marriage movement before we had Obergefell redefining marriage, is that reporters aren't necessarily always investigating all sides of the story and then sitting down to write the story, but rather the story's already written, and then they have to get their obligatory quote from, quote, the other side, and then they can come back and file their story. So I know I've experienced that myself as a pro-life advocate. Do you notice that happening more in what you, I know as a reporter yourself, you probably read a lot. And then how much of it do you think is the reporters themselves, or is it their editors, or does it go all the way up to the owners of the outlets?
Well, I think for starters, not every reporter has the ability to pick what story that they want to write / the angle that they want to write.
Okay.
So if your editor assigns you an angle or a story, sometimes you have to go out and ping someone for that quote because you were told to do that.
Mm.
If you are in the more luxurious position of writing about things you deeply care about and you want to pursue, then you are able to do this more investigative work to formulate these kinds of stories. That's the kind of work I do, and I love it. I think that is so fulfilling to be able to chase down stories like that and learn why the story is important before you write it. But not everybody's in that position. And I think especially with outlets that do a lot of aggregating, these reporters, they've got a quota. They have to write a lot every day. And so their editor says, write this story and reach out to both sides. And that's kind of how it goes, unfortunately.
One of the, most egregious examples of this, I think, was during the trial for Dr. Kermit Gosnell, who was the abortionist in Philadelphia, who is now serving, I think, consecutive life sentences for birthing babies alive and then snapping their spinal cords. But I know that they had set aside several rows in the courtroom for media, and no one came. Literally, there was only one reporter from USA Today, and she tweeted out the jury box, not the jury box, rather, the media box, tweeted it out on Twitter saying, I'm the only reporter here covering this trial, and like shamed them into coming. And then all of a sudden the New York Times was there and, other outlets came, but they did not even, probably what was one of the biggest stories of the year in the abortion sphere, they didn't even bother to send a reporter to cover it. It was just outrageous.
Yeah.
And I think it did shame them into at least covering it. And for the most part, I thought they covered it fairly. I mean, they really did. The New York Times even pointed out that the judge had to order psychological counseling for the jury because they were so traumatized after what they said. But but yet everybody kind of quickly forgot about it. And now I think you're seeing kind of similar things where, stories that really should be covered. I think, for example, at Catholic Vote, we're tracking the number of aggressive attacks against Catholic churches.
Those trackers are so great.
And pregnancy resource centers.
Yeah.
No one else is doing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's if these were stories of, for example, a trans-affirming church or something, or trans-affirming churches during Pride Month being vandalized and, firebombed and that sort of thing, we'd never, we'd be hearing it every day.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, if you look, I've written a lot about this thanks to the Catholic Vote trackers, showing the disparity between these. Now there's, I think, over 200 attacks combined on Catholic churches and pro-life pregnancy centers or organizations since the Dobbs leak. And we've only seen, I believe, 4 people charged with FACE Act violations by the Department of Justice.
Right.
And, the FACE Act matters because the DOJ has been using the FACE Act to charge pro-life activists in order to target these people like Mark Houck, the father of 7, who was arrested by the FBI for his pro-life work. If you haven't seen our video, it's so good, Daily Signal.
Okay.
We were the first people to talk to his kids. We were able to sit down with them. It was a very emotional day. And so Mark was charged by the DOJ with a FACE Act violation. And they wanted to put him away. They offered him a plea deal, which he didn't accept. And then ultimately, a jury found him not guilty. But while you have these 200 plus attacks, then you have a father like Mark Houck. That's who the DOJ decides to prosecute with the FACE Act. And then, you know, so these disparities, we've been covering them a lot at the Daily Signal. And thanks to Catholic Vote, we have trackers like this. But you're right, not many people are willing to shine a light on this and to even show the disparity here.
Yeah, well, even, you know, the attempt on the life of Justice Brett Kavanaugh.
Right.
I mean, had that been one of the other justices, and I would not defend this against any justice for any reason. I mean, judges have to be able to rule according to the law without threat of, you know, that's a time-honored principle in the American legal system. But it was a really muted coverage of, you know, of that particular event. And I thought if that had, God forbid, been Ruth Bader Ginsburg or Ketanji Brown Jackson or, you know, one of the other justices in the minority right now, we'd probably still be having a daily update on what the trial, when the trial was going to start, et cetera, et cetera.
And we haven't heard anything about Nicholas Roski in forever. I was just looking it up. I was like, what's going on with Nicholas Roski? That's the attempted Kavanaugh assassin. I asked the United States Marshals Service if I reached out as a press inquiry and said, if pro-life activists are planning a protest outside the home of justice, any of the liberal justices, what would the marshals do about it? Because the marshals are stationed outside the homes of the justices, and there's a federal law that says you cannot picket or parade outside the home of a justice with the intent of intimidating that justice. And Attorney General Merrick Garland acknowledged that that law exists and that he hasn't done anything about it, even though Governor Youngkin of Virginia and the former governor of Maryland asked him to do that. I didn't get any response from the United States Marshal Service. They're not engaging with us on whether they would act in the same manner if it was a liberal justice, but Justice Kavanaugh and his family have had to face these dangers over the past couple of months.
And he has young children, school-age.
And Amy Coney Barrett also has a lot of children.
I know it was publicized where they attend Mass on Sundays.
Yes. And their school.
And the kids' schools. And, you know, I remember the Obamas, and rightly so, when they took office, being extremely protective about Sasha and Malia. And, you know, saying very strongly that whether it was Amy Carter or their children or Chelsea Clinton, people's children are off limits.
Right.
You are the Bush twins, you know, stay away from people's children. They did not choose to run for office, et cetera. And that seems not to be a thing anymore.
Yeah, any decent person knows that you stay away from someone's kids.
Right.
That's not.
Yeah, it just is. Even if it's only kind of what they call soft threats, they're still threats.
Right.
And these are still children. So, well, thank you. I'm glad that you're following up on those things.
Oh, yeah.
And, well, you mentioned Glenn Youngkin. So when Glenn Youngkin was running for governor of Virginia, he had one press conference, and if I recall correctly, virtually none of the questions were about policy, about his campaign, about contrasting him with his opponent.
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, his team decided that they wouldn't do any more press conferences because it made no sense to try to communicate with a media who was not willing to ask them stories about the campaign. They couldn't campaign with voters, communicate to voters that way.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty serious shift in the way that people used to run for office in this country. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think that's an interesting example because I actually, you know, I think that Glenn Youngkin has done some amazing things since he became governor of Virginia. It's a very nice change from Governor Northam.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember when he was running his campaign, I had a lot of questions for the campaign about where he stood on abortion, and I think there was a woman who recorded him saying to a voter that he couldn't really lean into abortion because it would tank him in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And this was before all the Loudoun County stuff.
Right.
And I was kind of floored by this and thought, well, if you won't talk about abortion, and I was asking, I said, can you talk to me about abortion? Because I want to report on what you think about this.
Right.
And I thought, oh, well, if you can't share that side of things to the so many pro-life Virginians that want to hear, well, how is this going to go?
Right.
And then the tide really turned for him when he leaned into education
and parental rights,
which is, you know, people are a little more comfortable with parental rights and education than they are with abortion. I think especially GOP, they are much more comfortable highlighting the fight for women's spaces than they are getting into the nitty-gritty on abortion.
Right.
So that's just something that I've noticed in the GOP in general as a culture reporter. But in terms of how politicians interact with the media, I think that on the one hand, it's smart of them to not talk to every reporter, because largely if you are on one side of the aisle, half the reporters you talk to are out to get you, and they're going to misrepresent you or misquote you. Good example of this is Ron DeSantis in Florida. His media team is so good. Yeah. I was at a Sunshine Summit in Florida maybe last year, and the governor was speaking there. And Governor DeSantis's team was in charge of who and what media were allowed into the event. And they knew that several very, very liberal reporters were trying to attend the event. And they straight up said, you can't come because you're dishonest media and we have no interest in allowing you to come. Mm-hmm. And it caused a huge uproar. People were really upset. One of the Washington Post reporters came and sat outside the event and just kind of lurked around waiting to see what he could get from it. And they got a lot of flack for doing that, right. But it was their call. You know, it's a Florida GOP summit, and that's how they chose to handle that. You see a lot of different politicians handle it differently, though.
Well, Donald Trump was a master at that.
He talked to everybody. He doesn't do that now, but he did then.
But would also call out people very publicly if he thought they were being dishonest.
He did,
you know?
Yes.
And I think, you know, it was kind of interesting to watch the reactions, because all of a sudden, you know, you see some in the press pool like, oh, wow, like, we're going to be held accountable. Like, we, you know, it
really
you
can't get away with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I also think that it's important to call out media for things like that. My pet peeve is these local reporters who are activists, and they'll write about these issues and just matter of factly use activist language to talk about these things. So whenever I see it now on Twitter, I like to tag the writer, you know, and usually they're someone that has a very small account. They're just like a local reporter. But I like to tag them and say, why did you use this language? Did your editor tell you to do this, or did you do this on your own? Because you're deceiving your readers and tricking them into thinking something that isn't true. And for example, we've been talking about gender affirming care a lot. When these writers use that phrase, either they decided, oh, I'm not going to say that these are irreversible sex change procedures. Either the writer decided, I'm going to tell people how to think about this, or their editor said, use this phrase because so-and-so said to, or because this activist media guide says to. And either way, they should have to answer for why they're doing that, because that's not the truth. That is literally not the truth.
Well, we're not calling pregnant women anymore. They're pregnant people.
Right. Pregnant people. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it just, honestly, it's Orwellian. But yeah. Well, so you mentioned Ron DeSantis, and he announced his presidential run on Twitter, and again, not in the traditional, you know, campaign step, or even the, you know, the President Trump kind of coming down the escalator kind of dramatic thing. What did you think of his decision to do it that way?
Yeah, that was interesting. I was listening to it in the car, actually, because I was at a friend's wedding festivities and I was driving home, and I thought it was my signal because it kept breaking up, but his announcement crashed Twitter, so it took a little while to get started. And I knew a lot of people were very horrified by that. They thought it was a failure because it kept crashing. I don't know. I think we won't really know how effective that was for a while. But I will say it was kind of a hat tip to Elon Musk for trying to be more receptive to freedom of speech on Twitter, and for not censoring people the way that people used to be censored on Twitter. And also it kind of blocked out all these media outlets that would be vying for that attention, that maybe, you know, Fox News is kind of the typical outlet where you would think that DeSantis would announce his presidency. Well, he opted for Twitter. I think that was a really interesting statement to
make
there.
And now Tucker Carlson.
And Fox booted Tucker, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I have no idea if Ron DeSantis' decision to go on Twitter for that announcement had something to do with Fox itself. We know that Fox corporate just follows along with the human rights campaign's directives, and they're very, very, very woke. We did a big story at the Daily Signal recently where we exposed Fox's gender transition guidelines. They help employees transition their gender in the office. And I had a bunch of people come to me anonymously and say that a lot of Fox employees are not conservative, and that the company isn't that concerned about conservative values, and that they're saying one thing and doing another. But, you know, I have friends that work at Fox and they're good people that are trying to tell the truth. So it's a mixed bag.
Well, outside of politics and then important moral issues like abortion, what are your other favorite things to cover as a reporter?
I had a really fun time during COVID covering the politicians who tell you to do one thing and do another. Mm-hmm. We absolutely hammered that when I was at the Daily Caller. And that's what kind of that hypocrisy angle I was talking about.
Right.
I believe it was Thanksgiving 2020 when right before everybody started saying, don't travel, stay home, don't go anywhere. And then like four different politicians very blatantly traveled across state lines to go see their family. So just one after another, you know, someone would say, I just saw, I don't know, who the Newsom in the airport. And we'd get the screenshot.
Again, Newsom at the French Laundry.
The French Laundry, that was a great one. And we just, there were like dozens of stories like that.
Nancy Pelosi getting her hair done.
Yes. Oh, London Breed, the mayor. She also had a hair situation, or she said that something along the lines of, I am the face of this city, so I have to. And we just did one story after another, trying to highlight that absolute nonsensical hypocrisy there. So that was fun and kind of more lighthearted, even though obviously the pandemic had a very strong effect on a lot of people. I also have really enjoyed reporting on the Me Too movement, on people's allegations against high-profile people. We did a lot of that on Tara Reid, who accused Joe Biden of sexual assault. We also did a lot of reporting on Governor Cuomo's accusers in New York. But the culture wars are really my passion. I care a lot about writing about abortion, marriage, family, gender. Children's innocence, at the end of the day, is, I think, what I am most passionate about. And a lot of these issues touch on that at the end of the day. Protecting children's innocence and the integrity of the family and femininity, dignity, these things all come back together. And of course, Catholicism. But as the politics reporter, that only comes into the picture sometimes.
We saw a conversion of the church and politics when Amy Coney Barrett was nominated, because all of a sudden people became very interested in the particular Catholic lay movement that she was part of. And, you know, we're implying that it was a cult and that sort of thing.
I did a piece that I was very proud of at the time where I compared how the media talked about Joe Biden's Catholicism versus Amy Coney Barrett's Catholicism. Biden's Catholicism, even though he's the most pro-abortion president in United States history, is considered devout. And Amy Coney Barrett's Catholicism is considered extreme. And in one of my favorite projects I ever did, my colleague and I went to the Women's March right before her confirmation, and we asked people, what's the most dangerous thing about Amy Coney Barrett? Because, and to kind of set the scene, the Women's March is a crazy crowd. It's very, you know, vulgar, lots of inappropriate signs and hats and skin and writing and stuff like that. And so we knew that the crowd we were walking into was hostile. And we wanted to know what you actually think about Amy Coney Barrett. So we asked them that question because we knew they would tell us if we said it in that manner. And I cannot tell you how many people told me the most dangerous thing about her was her Catholicism or the number of kids she had. And all these people, I would say, okay, so you think the most dangerous thing about her is her Catholicism? Does that make her unfit to serve as a judge? And they were like, yeah, no way. And so that's what this radical side of the spectrum thought about that issue. And I think videos like that are very enlightening because the majority of Americans don't think like that. But that's the radical leftist side of this issue. And I think it helps people to see things like that and think, no, we shouldn't disqualify someone for the Supreme Court because of their religious views or because of how many kids they have. And that was a very interesting news cycle to be a part of. Also, just highlighting, there was someone on Twitter, I remember, that tried to say that Amy Coney Barrett was racist because she adopted her children. There wasn't anything else there. There was a white savior complex.
Couple of those accusations.
It was so outrageous. Yeah. And all of it ended up tying back to her religion because, you know, when you have a lot of kids, people always tie that back to your religion. Like, oh, you're crazy religious zealot because you have 10 kids.
Right.
So that was a news cycle that I dove into headlong. I think I was writing like 8 stories a day at one point.
Oh, my goodness.
But it's really cool to be able to cover that kind of thing, you know, because like I was saying before, not everyone will write about it. So it leaves a hole and then you fill the hole and everyone's reading your story because it's the only one that was written about
that. Exactly.
And I think that in a way, conservative journalists who are interested in covering these issues, it carves out a niche for you because no one else is doing it.
Right. And the same way Barry Weiss did.
Yeah. Yes.
And Tucker. And yeah. You make a name for yourself simply by being truthful and straightforward. So,
right.
Well, what is one story or issue that you don't see the mainstream press covering that really should be covered?
Well, I probably would say one side of the abortion debate. I would also say detransitioners. The mainstream mm-hmm. media will not talk about them.
Yeah.
And that is a very, very sad thing because these are people who have suffered a lot and tried to change their gender, obviously couldn't because that is not possible. And now they're left to pick up the pieces. And as I was sharing with you a little earlier, there's no doctors to help these people through this. And mainstream media, if they ever talk about these people, they always say something like, only a small portion of people regret their transitions. Well, that's because these transgender doctors won't help them. And so half of the detransitioners never even go back to report that they regret what they did because they're afraid and they know that they're going to be told, oh, maybe you didn't try hard enough, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think that the one half of the abortion debate is not covered by the mainstream media whatsoever. You will never hear a crisis pregnancy center called that.
Mm-hmm.
You will call, what do they call them? Anti-abortion
yeah.
clinic?
Something like that.
They have weird names for them.
Mm-hmm.
Google helps to suppress these pro-life crisis pregnancy centers.
Right.
If you try and Google one of those in a certain area, Google will tell you where the Planned Parenthood is.
Mm-hmm.
It's so unacceptable. And the New York Times will go to an abortion clinic and do this glitzy, glamorous spread with photos showing the abortion doctor, showing the patient, showing the inside of the abortion clinic.
Thank you notes taped to the,
yeah,
you know,
thank
to the,
you notes.
To the walls there. Thank women thanking them for their wonderful
Even
care.
Even the surgical yeah. instruments. Not as much anymore because I don't think they want people to know how that works. And they never do that for the pro-life pregnancy centers. And they use the abortion language to talk about them. They'll say that they exist to misinform and deter. That's literally a quote from Leanna Wen, the former president of Planned Parenthood. But that's what the media uses to describe pro-life crisis pregnancy centers.
Mm-hmm.
And so something I'd love to do someday is to do one of those spreads of a pro-life crisis pregnancy center, go in with a really good photographer and take pictures of these women mm-hmm. and these pro-life pregnancy centers and show people what actually goes on inside. Because during the overturn of Roe last year, I remember all these horrible people were saying awful things about crisis pregnancy centers online. And you can be pro-abortion and still understand the mm-hmm. good that these pregnancy centers
right.
do. If you're a logical person, even if you think that a woman should be able to get an abortion, mm-hmm. you should also be able to look at a pro-life pregnancy center and be like, wow, that place is full to the brim with diapers. That seems like a good thing.
Right.
And so I was so frustrated, and I made this thread on Twitter, and I said someone had called them dangerous pregnancy, mm-hmm. dangerous anti-abortion clinics. And so I posted a bunch of pictures of the inside of Capitol Hill Crisis Pregnancy Center, which had been vandalized.
Yeah.
And I said, look at this dangerous pregnancy center or something.
Good for you.
And it was full to the brim with baby clothes and diapers.
Yeah.
And I was just mad and posted it on Twitter and went back to work. And the next thing I knew, it was viral and all these people were saying, yes, look, this is what it does. So I think that people need to see more things like that. You know, we need to see more evidence rather than just... you know, a lot of the time when we cover abortion, reporters will write a story about legislation passing and just do a picture of like the March for Life. And that's good that they're writing about the legislation passing. That is news and we should cover that. But I'm not really that interested in clicking that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
What I am interested in, and clicks are, you know, we care a lot about those. what I am interested in is the women that are doing the work to help these people or the
right.
woman that had three kids and was thinking about aborting her fourth because the dad left them and their stories. So
well, the only fair story I've seen on story singular was done by Jan Crawford at CBS News. And she did a beautiful feature on a pregnancy maternity home and pregnancy center in Virginia where she's interviewing these women and she interviews the director of the center and they, you know, they do a whole kind of walkthrough of the pregnancy maternity home. And
was this Mary Shelter?
Yes, Mary Shelter. You've got to look it up. Yeah. It is fantastic. And she's interviewing these two women, one of whom was pregnant and sleeping in the back of the dumpster in the fast food restaurant where she worked. And so she said, you were sleeping behind a dumpster. And she said, yes, I was sleeping behind a dumpster. And now she's living here. And it was the most beautiful fair story. And then it cut back to the anchor and he said, well, you know, thank you for your reporting, but we all need to remember it's the woman who makes the choice. Like, you had to get something in. You couldn't just leave something nice alone. But the story itself, I'm to this day astounded that it even aired.
I had the privilege of meeting the director of Mary's Shelter, mm-hmm. and we did a little feature story on the shelter at Christmas time and talked to a bunch of these girls and these women that had been there. It was amazing. Yeah. Mary's Shelter is one of the places I would like to go and do a little photo shoot ourselves.
Right. Yeah, no, and Mary's Shelter, you know, can be duplicated across the country because there's in virtually in all the years I've worked in pro-life, I don't think I've ever been to a major city where there isn't at least one place like a Mary's Shelter.
Usually kind of close to an abortion clinic.
Sometimes, but but there's always something where the pro-life people in the community step up to say, no, we can provide you with something better. Right. Yes, we will help you, you know. And I just to kind of close out, going back to Amy Coney Barrett, I think, you know, what she reflects to them is everything that they say that the pro-life movement isn't. They say, oh, you know, what about all these kids in foster care? You won't adopt any of these, you know, poor black children. She has adopted two black children from Haiti. Oh, you'll adopt, but you only want white babies. No, she's adopted two black children from Haiti. What would you do if you were diagnosed with a baby with a, you know, a life-limiting condition or a condition where the child would have lifelong disabilities? Well, she's got a little boy with Down syndrome. So in every instance where, you know, we're often accused of only wanting perfect babies to be born, I think she's a reflection back to them that, this is what the pro-life movement is. We love who God puts in our path, and we care for God who, you know, just like the Good Samaritan, you take what is put in front of you and try to do God's will. So, well, thank you for doing God's will and in being present in what can I only be described, I would think, as a very hostile environment sometimes. So God bless you, Mary Margaret Ohan. It was great to be with you today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening. To make it easier for you to listen to future Edify podcast episodes, please make sure you subscribe over at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. Thank you.